Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big social, economic and environmental issues. And most importantly, we focus on the solutions that can make this country and this world a more fair and equal place. I'm Rory Hearn, your host, and joined, as always, by Tony Groves, my alter ego and co-host. Tony, how are you?
I'm very good, Rory. Listeners, please head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Our podcasts, you know, great people like Lalani Farah, great people from across different realms, activists, politicians, and generally people who give a damn. We can get them on, but we can't get them on unless we have the support. These things don't fund themselves, and I can tell you that we really do appreciate every cent that we get. Give us the price of a cup of coffee.
We're joined today by Naomi Klein, journalist, author, filmmaker and activist, award-winning New York Times bestselling author of 7 critically acclaimed books, published in over 30 languages, and senior correspondent at The Intercept and the inaugural Gloria Steinem endowed chair at Rutgers University. Her new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, is published and out. I hope you're doing well. How are you feeling?
I am well. It's been a hectic few days in London, but it's been good.
Good, good. So Naomi, as parents, we worry for the future of our children. You know, and we have children who have taken part in the climate strikes, and, you know, having children expands your horizon in terms of you think about their future and, you know, our children's future. And really wonder, you know, is this a time of hope or despair? And have we failed our children in terms of climate change? Or can we still turn it around?
So, okay, well, we have done a really, really bad job. And it's not, there isn't a real universal we in this. And I don't think it is, honestly, a generational issue as much as it is about the economic systems that have failed, young people, that are failing many elderly people. And, you know, I've been so inspired by the youth climate strike movement, by the leadership young people are playing in so many aspects of the climate movement, including the fossil fuel divestment movement, including the movements demanding a Green New Deal. We're seeing such visionary leadership. But I don't, you know, I still think that we need to reject the framing of it, of this as one generation failing another, because that sort of diverts attention from the economic interests that have been driving this crisis and the economic ideology that makes it so impossible, frankly, for us to do the big things, to embrace the transformative change that the science demands of us. So we have a very, very narrow window where we could, in which we could succeed, if we really did embrace the vision that is embodied in a Green New Deal framework, which is an approach to the climate crisis that unites the deep desire for a fair economy, for a world in which human beings aren't discarded and treated as if their lives are of no value, left to drown in the Mediterranean or, you know, on many other borders around the world, or in the climate crisis itself. So I think that we do have this very narrow window, and rather than worrying about whether that we've failed or not, we just need to do everything we can to win, to make the most of this very short window that we have and fight like our lives depend on it, because they do. And one other thing I would add is that, you know, I am a mom, and there's no doubt that having a child is, it does expand your time horizons. But I also have so many friends who don't have children and are fighting so hard. And, you know, I think that parents don't have any kind of monopoly on love for future generations. And, you know, and I think our love needs to expand so far beyond our own children, and it does. So we're, you know, we're fighting for all children, and it's all of us, including those of us without children.
Yeah, no, that's very true, and I think it's very excellently put. Just could you maybe outline, because it's in your new book, which is excellent, On Fire, The Burning Case for the Green New Deal. Could you outline specifically what is in the Green New Deal that you're advocating for listeners?
Yes, so, well, there's a lot, but the framework for the Green New Deal that I'm talking about comes out of the climate justice movement, which is a movement of frontline communities that have really had to bear the burden of our economy's reliance on fossil fuels, because they are the communities that have had the dirtiest industries in their backyards, whose lands have been destroyed by mining. And these are overwhelmingly indigenous communities, immigrant communities, black and brown communities. And the Global South has been pushing for a justice-based response to the climate crisis, one that tackles economic inequality and injustice, racial injustice, gender exclusion, at the same time as we lower our carbon emissions. So what this means concretely is that we're guided by science. We embrace the very rapid decarbonization framework that was laid out in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's 1.5 report from a year ago. But that in transforming our infrastructure in line with those targets, we very deliberately wage war on poverty and inequalities on every front. So in the Green New Deal resolution that was drafted by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey in the United States, that includes the principle that frontline communities need to benefit from this transition. It includes the principle that no worker should be left behind, so that workers in high carbon sectors, as they move into clean sectors, need to maintain their salary and benefits levels and need to democratically participate in the transition. It is a jobs program, but making sure that the jobs are paying wages that can support families. The AOC Ed Markey resolution also includes Medicare for all, universal public health care. It includes child care for all. So it's really it includes free public education at the college level. So, you know, I think it's really a holistic vision for the next economy that recognizes that within a context of rapid decarbonization, there are going to be areas where we are going to have to all sacrifice and make changes. If people are going to embrace this transition, that there also have to be areas where people's lives improve, right? Mm. Where people's lives get easier. And that's why it is so important to have the healthcare, have healthcare in there, to have a mental health, in there, to have child care in there. You know, there's been criticisms like, what is this in there? It's just a laundry list of like everything the left has always wanted.
Yeah.
And the argument I make is, you know, it's twofold. One, you know, these are low carbon professions. There, it doesn't burn a lot of carbon to teach kids, you know, to care for the elderly, and the sick. We can make these sectors even lower carbon under a Green New Deal. Mm. But the other thing is that we need to recognize is that by linking economic and social justice to decarbonization, it actually makes these policies more popular. Because what we see again and again is when you have neoliberal climate policies that just increase the cost of living for working people, right? Just asks people who are already incredibly overstressed and overburdened to pay more for electricity or to pay more for petrol. At the same time, as they're dealing with austerity, attacks on working standards, and they're watching the ultra rich make out like bandits, that leads to backlash. And we saw that in France with the Yellow Vest movement, and we've seen it, you know, in less dramatic fashion in many other contexts, including where I'm from, Canada, where carbon pricing came to be seen, you know, as as a sort of a luxury issue that just, you know, hiked people's electricity bills. And it has been used by the right to stir up a populist backlash. And, you know, in some provinces, we've lost those policies as a result. So I think it's really actually pragmatic to be more ambitious and intersectional in how we respond to this crisis.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really well, you know, explained. And one area in particular for Ireland here, a big issue is the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think housing as well could be brought as a core issue within the Green New Deal in terms of providing, you know, low carbon, zero carbon homes, affordable homes for people as a core part of the just transition.
Absolutely. Homes and transit. Are, you know, a big investments in public transit, maybe even making it free if you really want people to use it. And affordable housing in urban centers along those transit lines. And, you know, we're also looking at models that have health clinics on the first floors of those affordable housing units, right? Along those transit lines, as a way of integrating the care economy into those sectors. But listen, you know, this is a real non-negotiable, because we know that when we don't prioritize affordable housing, that what we end up with is urban sprawl. You end up with these green gentrified cities where working people can't afford to live. They get forced into the exurbs without transit links. The rich people in their green gentrified cities don't even like taking transit. They drive anyway. Who would use transit don't have access to it and have to drive. So we've seen this, you know, this recipe repeated, you know, again and again. So I agree with you completely. Housing has to be at the center, and we're going to see some interesting legislation on this coming forward in the U.S. in very soon, actually.
Naomi, just going back to what you said earlier about the neoliberal agenda tends to play onto the carbon tax, the carbon issue, and how it can be a regressive tax. And what we're finding, obviously, there's a flat tax here. The last time you were in Dublin, you spoke about support for the water protest movement, and you know that movement ultimately was successful insofar as the water charges were put away, but you know, we're facing into this now with a flat regressive tax. I'd be interested to see what you think of that as a model, and what model should be adopted.
So carbon taxes have to be progressive. They have to reflect who created this crisis and who the overconsumers are. We know that globally the top 20% of consumers are responsible for 70% of emissions. And within our countries, the wealthier you are, the more carbon you burn. Mm. So, you know, we need to ask those who have the most to pay the most. And we need, carbon taxes to be, revenue neutral for working people. I mean, that's what a real progressive carbon tax would be. And I think that these flat taxes are, you know, my fear is that they really generate backlash. So it's not just that they're not, you know, they're never high enough to actually lower emissions on anything like the scale that we need, first of all. And second of all, you solidify and reconfirm this narrative that climate action is a war on working people. You know, the slogan in France, we should never forget the Yellow Vest movement's slogan, you care about the end of the world, we care about the end of the month. It is precisely that dichotomy that the climate movement needs to explode. And we need to make the case to working people that they have the right to care about both, and that there are policies that will not force them to choose.
No, and that's absolutely true, Naomi. And I think about, you know, when we marched back, you know, almost 20 years ago against the G8 summits in terms of being part of the global justice and anti-war movement, and with the critiques we had of financial capitalism and inequality, that protest movement rose and fell. Do you think that this climate movement can achieve what those movements didn't in terms of actually transforming our system towards a more socially just and environmentally sustainable societies and economies, and particularly given the challenges of kind of the Trump Johnson kind of rise of authoritarian neoliberalism?
It has to. The alternative is unthinkable. Everything is on the line. And our past movement failures, let's be frank, have helped create the reality that we are in now. It is the global trading system that we opposed at the end of the 1990s and into the 2000s that is responsible for a huge emission spike globally. This is the most carbon intensive way to produce goods that you could ever design. It is based on an absolute denial of the climate emergency, the idea that we make our goods through this web of global web of contractors and subcontractors and ship the parts and finished products around the world as if carbon doesn't matter. And the failure to rein in the banks after the 2008 financial crisis also led us to this moment. I'm not saying it is all on our movements. Of course, the responsibility is mostly on the people who were elected, who failed on these fronts. But the fact is that we have to learn from our mistakes. And I believe that we are learning from our mistakes. I think the reason why so many people, many of whom are also veterans of those movements, are now foregrounding a Green New Deal as a response to the climate crisis is because they learned the lesson of the fact that it is dangerous to have a movement that is primarily simply oppositional, simply saying no, without a very clear alternative. Because what can happen is you open up a vacuum that can then be exploited by very nefarious forces. And I have to tell you, being in London right now, you know, I'm very grateful to Extinction Rebellion for the political space that they have created in sort of declaring a climate emergency from below and creating spaces for so many people to come together and express their outrage and their desire for action. But I'm also concerned about the idea of just yelling fire and not putting forward our solutions for putting the fire out. Because we need to yell fire, and we need to put forward these solutions that come out of decades and decades of work from the environmental justice movement all around the world. We know what we need to do in the face of this crisis. We cannot be afraid to put forward our solutions, because if we don't, then we run the risk of creating openings that will be exploited by others. And this is something that I talk about in the book. The right is already starting to respond to the reality of climate disruption with hate, with xenophobia, with attacks on immigrants.
Yeah.
We absolutely cannot afford to just intensify a state of emergency without putting forward justice-based solutions. So, you know, I've been publicly supporting Extinction Rebellion's activism, although I don't like it when they block the tube. I think that's a great way to turn off working people. But I really believe that they need to learn from the mistakes of past social movements that created political openings and did not put forward with confidence real solutions. And just saying we're going to have, a citizens assembly and figure it out then is not a real answer in this time of multiple fires, because we are facing the fires of the climate emergency, and we are also facing the fires of fascism. And we need to take that extremely seriously.
Listen, Naomi, thank you so much for joining us. I think you really raised the issue of the question of political alternatives as well, and how this whole movement expresses itself and achieves its political aims. And we're really looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night in Dublin. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I'll see you tomorrow.
We'll see you tomorrow, Naomi. Thank you so much.
Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
I think, Rory, what we found there was that Naomi covered. We had several questions from listeners, and we had to actually go short on them because most of them were in her answers, because they were so wide-ranging. Naomi, we want to give thanks to Naomi for her time. We also want to credit Lorna Gold.
Yes, absolutely. Lorna helped set this up and make it happen. So thank you, Lorna, part of the climate movement and lecturer in applied social studies in Maynooth as well, and longtime author and activist around climate. I hope listeners found, as we did, Naomi, very inspiring and fascinating in terms of her analysis. I'd really encourage you to get her new book, to have a read of it. And I think she raised a lot of challenges in terms of how we progress towards a just and environmentally sustainable world.
Listen, folks, really appreciate you listening. These things don't generate their own, don't finance themselves. Head on over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The price of a cup of coffee helps us keep this going.
And just a reminder, I'm not sure if there are tickets ready left for tomorrow night, but for Naomi Klein is speaking Friday night in the National Theatre. If you go online, you'll find tickets
there,
for that.
There are a handful of tickets left, literally a handful of tickets.
You might be the one who gets it.
All right. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.